broken silence. Soldiers break village silence with body cries. Drunken grabbing hens, dies hoarding, taking. They demand their entertainment and demean themselves with all they see, for all to see. Soldiers on a wartime stage, stared at and judged, looked at but unseen, loud and ever unheard. Late at night, killing temporarily abated, soldiers dream of silence. But nightmares split, dreams are broken, and soldiers' terrified screams break again the silence.
Thanks, mate. And next we have Anne-Marie Granfield.
This poem was in Peru in April, and it's just using their own terms there and just put it together. So. It's called Inti, which means sun. So when you feel compelled to write, you do. The pen hits the paper, and then it just releases. I'm offering to you, Satchamama, my worries and cares. I'm offering to you my dreams and desires. To you, Satchamama, I give you my love. The flames lick round, engulfing our dreams, our destinies. The winds come, sambuchas, sambuchas. They take with them our prayers, and Satchamama welcomes our gifts and says thank you. But our journey doesn't end there, it only begins. Of many more to be buried, burnt, and given to the winds. We embrace all of it, Mama Kilia, Mother Moon. Satchamama, Mother Earth, Papa Inti, Father Sun. To all the elements, to all the archetypes, to our future. Lubrication Koi, a million thanks. I blow to you, I give to you, I sing to you, I thank you. Let our dreams be where we meet the spirits. Let our dreams be our portals to help heal us, to help make us become who we are. Come, come, let us celebrate. Let us celebrate us.
Thanks, Anne-Marie. And next we have Mari Pogany.
I forgot my poem, so I'm going to read that off the book, and I hope I haven't read it already. I don't think I have. It's called First Poem. My mother kept a birth call tucked in the side pocket of her bag. Forceps like my small fingers would fish it out, unfold the warm brown envelope, hold the web-like skin up to the light. She'd tell me once again it was a talisman, good luck charm for sailors, the look on her eyes as far away as the sea. I didn't know it was a cherished membrane taken from her firstborn's head, the boy who fell from his sea-blue cot.
Thank you, Mari. And next, the lady responsible for bringing all these Australians upon us, Robin Roden.
Yeah!
Thank you. I'm really delighted I did, because it was just such a fantastic reading. Really enjoyed that. So I think I might just read you a new one tonight, actually. This is from A Visit to Inishman, which I think is the real McCoy, really. And it was a friend of mine took me there for my birthday earlier this year, which was a real treat. So it's called The Solitude of Friends. For Una, I'm visiting Inishman. Here is the place of solitude, its beginning and its end. Among the rock and the sea casting itself about. Among the stars shifted away by rain and the small night sounds that only come from other creatures, not human. Here you found a place to be common with it, to find the bowl of self inside that washes at will with the tides and storms, remains as sure as the walls of Doon Cahul. Each day we walk a different path here, your birthday gift to me of beauty. We carry our soup and griddle bread, our singleness, our friendship. The plants are braving a cold spring, hawthorn and juniper wind sculpted, yet soil that was made by hand over centuries from seaweed, crushed limestone and sand, made itself rich by waiting and flowers now with colour that makes the rainbow over Connacht pale. Some would find this place desolate, giant pavements of compacted layers, the breaking cliffs sharp falling into boiling water, boulders thrown up from the depths that waited on a storm to rain them down, the broken craggy hills with fretted fences, stone lacework to let the wind through, a crocheted set of borders that keep only beasts out, but we thrive on its purity. Profuse lichen and mosses coat the weary slate grey platforms, thriving in the cleanest Atlantic air, all pollution lost on its way or beaten out of it by storms. There are springs that drop from cliffs to small pools, green with light, lisping those concentric circles that show movement comes out of small things. Time lives here and has no fuss with us. Allows just standing to look into crevices where the eyes of bluebells gaze out. Kahia Singh, where Singh wrote out an awe of the place, the people, it's really older than before this his time, a collection of rocks that were placed there for a lookout post by men of unknown strength. We sit beside its inside its solid borders on a damp day, wind biting and impatient with light. Being used to living alone in our quiet houses, we share easily both silence and talk, you in your scarlet hat and coat, mine bright blue. Singh wrote so much of a primitive people here and the romantic notion that hard times were good, prosperity a sully on purity. Some of it, of course, was right and written with the true rhythm of the place. But reality was the courage to get into a tar and timber curragh and go fishing for your life, or to bring turf in from Galway on a wild sea, or the doctor and priest, knowing one was as likely needed with the other. Women no longer wear Singh's red petticoats dyed from madder roots, nor stir their indigo in pots by the fire. Keeping that close as a memory is not false record. He wrote of what was authentic in that life, endurance and facing fear. Nothing romantic about that. It comes out of necessity. Like when they told us each our breasts had cells that had turned sly, caused chaos, and to save the body, the flesh must be carved out. Now we carry more scars than that with us. What we learned was that bliss is not found in the body, but happiness is as powerful as an ocean's swell and just as capricious. That contentment may inhabit a moment when we walk together the expanse of curved sandy beach, suddenly soft on this rock island, leaving behind us the only two sets of prints. And in knowing that when the Arctic gulls dive at us to protect their nests, we simply change direction. At late dusk, wine and the taste of sea from Rory's delicate food remain on our tongues with the easy words. Straw Island Lighthouse is fierce bright with its double pulse, though the sound is still. Beyond, the uncertain sea, and our bends blue as periwinkles growing in crevices outside this long window that frames a panorama we can't, we don't need to take back. You said once that loneliness is the price we pay for a certain kind of freedom. This kind? To move into the world unbound, to know the nature of islands and move among them, to arrive and know the fit of this place as if matched by heart, stone by stone, silence on silence. We sit to watch light leave the silver slabs before us, night drifting in as if a mist, settled in the quiet companionships of friends alone.
Thank you, Robin. We'll be going to Inish Mount soon. Next up we have David Jordan.
This is a poem called My Religion. It's basically about music. Music is my religion, a mystery religion. O Orpheus, the stars in the universe have nothing on you. And Terpsichore, lady of song and dance, the northern lights flicker and fade beside you. For music boggles the minds of the philosophers. Music stops the livid flame and calms the rancorous waves. It lends you the eyes of Apollo and the wings of Hermes. Music moves you to the edge of the dance floor, head nodding, holding a beer, looking to score. They say the devil has all the best tunes, but music makes me believe there's a God. Maybe it's a secret handshake twixt heaven and hell. If world peace ever breaks out, music will have played a part. Have faith in the lyre, Apollo's unbroken lyre, and music will take you higher than a bullet. Thanks.
Thank you, David. And next we have Mary O'Connell.
Thanks, Paul. This is called Cactus. Child of the land the sun has scorched, you cast a prickly shadow on unforgiving ground. Unloved and alone, your spiky arms rise up in supplication to end a stony watch. Few come along to cool your waxy skin, its thorny hide repudiating touch, a coat of mail to shield against attack. You have to suck what moisture is on tap beneath the barren soil, drinking through coiling roots. No blame for flowering intermittently. But when you do, the sheer flamboyance of those yellows, oranges, reds brings life to endless miles of level sand. Some flowers linger for a day or two. Others only open up at night. Birds and insects, even woodpeckers, find refuge in your briary arms. Travelers skilled in desert lore can reach your juicy pulp to slake their thirst. Held in the dying flames of sunset, you become a living candelabra. Thank you.
Thanks, Mary. And next we have Margaret Sargent.
Hi. So this is a new poem. When I was 15, my mother was diagnosed with breast cancer. So this is just kind of about how my family dealt with the whole treatment process. It is the fourth night my father yells at me for how I load the dishwasher, that I understand why he is yelling. Because you can't yell about IV drips or wig shopping or exhaustion, but you can yell about how I put the dishes in crooked so nothing fits right and I don't rinse them, so things that should wash away just stick. This is how my father says he is worried. It is the third time this week my brother calls from Austin to talk about his music, that I understand why he is calling. Because it's hard to say, how are you doing? to the woman who has had to learn the difference between queasy and nauseous. But it's easy to tell her about the Black Keys cover band you're playing in to make money. This is how my brother says he cares. I'm not sure what shape I expected cancer to take, this juggernaut of modern medicine, how I expected the battle to play out. But it was not losing 10 straight rounds of hospital room Scrabble to a bald woman with eyes and cheekbones that look like mine, trying to spell something meaningful with a handful of ceramic tiles. My father keeps score, watches as we string together a spiderweb of words that will never say what I need them to. Because there is no Q in I don't know what I'm doing. And there is no X in please don't die. If my mother were to play cancer in a game of Scrabble, all or nothing, she would spell vanquished on that board so fast cancer would not know what had hit it. Instead, she plays me, a less than worthy opponent. But this is how I say I'm here. And for now, this will have to be enough. Thank you.
Thank you, Margaret. And next we have Annie Wells.
This is one I wrote, I guess, this past fall for my brother. Seeing a grown man cry is a full body experience. You yearn to hug him and turn away at the same time. The look on his face transfixed me then. The abyss of questions floating by in his eyes, wishing for different answers. Fear, terror, anger, failure, and a fleeting glimpse of hope, all flashing in unison, vying for position, never knowing which would win in that moment. Standing at the back of the couch, he wept. Silently, but it filled the room. Never before had the house felt so expansive, yet crushing, and I was only watching the start of it unfold. I know what got us here, but I didn't see it happen. Only witness the aftermath, that cruel tangling of time when you wish it would simultaneously stop, slow down, speed up, and reverse. I know the words to say, but I strain to mean them. Pray for guidance and strength because I can tell already there is a long road ahead, no matter the signs of the fork or the path that we travel. I look into his eyes and am frozen in time and space and heartbeat. Why him? Why this way? I don't care about poetic justice or irony. Why must a man who always does what he's told, who strives to improve, be thrown away, left crumpled and discarded with no explanation or open door, never knowing how long this phase will last and forever shrouded in the twisting eternal pain of fear and failure? The empty blue void of helplessness mixes with the fiery red terror of anger, and what normally forms a loving purple now swirls into a black so deep it swallows him whole. For hours, days, weeks on end, never realizing how deep he is until once again he breaks the surface, not altogether willing. And once out, he prays to be submerged again because down there, there are no decisions. He simply follows and obeys, but out here, fear and helplessness take hold. He is bombarded with obstacles and reminders. Things he used to do. Tasks I now must do. He is used to being needed, not being the needy. Looking back, he's weathered it well, but the hail and the flooding did not pass unnoticed, as if Mother Nature was determined to remind us of what she saw we couldn't see. The glassy-eyed young man left battered and broken with a tree through his heart, head hung low, forever reliving his purpose and desire being stolen, ripped from his grasp, drop by drop. But this image has become ingrained this image has become ingrained on the back of my eyelids, the soles of my feet, and the palms of my hands. forever with me, surrounding me, embracing me, wrapping me up as it did him, searing in an instant. Smoldering for months, never to be removed or forgotten. Never before have I prayed for the drought to come, because though the rain might cleanse and give way to new life, she misses the imperfections. This is where she lays her silt, and no matter how you scrub, the scars of the broken remain.
Thank you, Annie. Just two more poets before we prepare for a glass of wine around the corner. And next we have Patricia Welch.
Thank you. This is called Madonna the Child. She's coming downstairs with a star of the sea in her head, and it's likely her heart where it should be. By rights, I came down to see what was happening. Bad or fright, nothing prepared me for what I saw. There was something in her heart that reached out and touched mine. Cynical as ever, I put it down to what I ate. Something is very wrong, but what does it matter when the doors are closed? She's only here for an hour anyway. In my head, I put her right where she belongs, in a picture of flower field, or my favourite, the pastures of home. Now I want to be everywhere with her, over and above a sense of time and place. But there is common sense to think of. Let her go. Half an hour passes. She disappears for six more. I sit on the sofa with the video on, but I don't follow. It's too much to ask.
Thank you, Trish. And to end up the evening is Grabber Art. Very, very short story.
Right, so, I was going to write a poem about my experiences up in Limerick at the One Stop Poetry Slam. I could only come up with kind of like half-forgotten cliches involving kind of swine and cows. So I just gave it up. Like, soap opera. Act one. What's that smell? I asked Jane. There's a stink in the top of the house and it seems to be getting worse. Yeah, I can smell it too. But I don't know where it's coming from. Act two. B burst into the kitchen, voice already at half shout, and flung my old work boots onto the floor at my feet. These are the boots I told you you could use. I watched him, compassion mixed with indignation. I knew he was stressed. His newish wife, our landlady, was our old boss who'd married him, lost her job, as had we, lost the house that went with her job, and subsequently spent a lot of time crying. They had no house and hadn't lived together since marrying 6 months before. She lived with her parents in the east, while he and I were two out of three people who shared a house in the south. The volume increased, spitting and swearing. Why the fuck did you do that to the fence? You made a right mess of that, didn't you? That's all you do, make a fucking mess. On and on in similar vein. A litany of faults and misdeeds delivered in bitchy, poisonous tones. I was aware enough to realise that this performance wasn't totally to do with me, and that he saw me as a convenient dumping ground for his unexpressed and unexamined feelings towards his new station in life. But there was another flavour to this brew, in which it was completely personal. He had been a friend of mine. Now he saw himself as my inquisitor. His mission, to punish me, to criticise and undermine me at every opportunity, and to delight in attempting to make my life miserable. He had become my enemy, and this kitchen skirmish of boots, fences, and a diseased imagination marked the beginning of another battle and a long war. Act 3. E, come up here. I go upstairs, and find Jay kneeling on the floor just inside his bedroom door. Smell here! I do. Phew! Your odour is indeed pungent. What is it? Smells like stale piss. Jay goes shopping for a remedy, then spends the next couple of hours sponging his carpet. My phone rings the next day. It's Jay calling from work. I know what happened. At first I thought it was a dream, but it's coming back to me now. I woke up one night last week and V was pissing into my bedroom. You must have been sleepwalking, I see. You mean drunk out of his head and disoriented. That's Jay. Act 4. Why is there a blanket on the couch? The cushions are getting holy. Maybe cigarette burns. Who burned the cushions? Probably Jay or one of his friends. They come back and party most weekends and always make a mess, though they do clean up. B goes off on one, complaining about people who don't respect stroke value other people's property. This couch, part of a well-worn three-piece suite, had been rescued from our neighbour who was throwing it out. I remind B of this, but he refuses to descend from his principled high ground. B doesn't live in the house anymore. The result of the kitchen skirmish and the smelly carpet was that he'd moved east to begin married life. He'd come down for a friend's party and assumed that he could stay the night. That night the house was full. Jay's brother was visiting and sleeping on the couch. B's old room had a new tenant, C, who ran a bar in town. I woke around 1:30 a.m. to the sound of B trying to force open my bedroom door. I asked him what he thought he was doing and received a barrage of invective before he shambled downstairs. I lay in my bed angry. My thoughts went back over the 10 years I had known B and my heart softened. We had had good times too, and I felt I owed him a hearing. With this in mind, I went down to the kitchen. I know at least 6 people who think you're untrustworthy and devious, and that you lie, cheat and steal. B is extremely drunk and stoned, but appears inviolate in the moral superiority of his contention. I'm reminded of the old saw, let he who is without sin cast the first stone, but B has no interest in listening to reason. After an hour and a half of this, I return to bed, but not before B has made a fuss about having to sleep on the floor. As I'm drifting off to sleep, I hear someone entering C's bedroom next door. 10:30 a.m, raised voices from the kitchen. B has one of the loudest voices of anyone I know, and he's hungover and agitated. He's arguing with Jay about holes and cushions, but Jay isn't having it. This is just normal wear and tear. I didn't burn holes in the cushions. He said you did. He said it was you. I arrived into the middle of this. E, did you tell him that I burned holes in the cushions? That's not what I said. You fucking liar! You told me yesterday it was him. Jay's brother, who's been on the couch all night, joins in. He didn't say that. I heard the pair of you last night, and he didn't say that. I sit down at the table and exchange glances with Jay and his brother. B is stalking up and down the kitchen. You told me it was him! You fucking told me! I stand up and approach him, grabbing him by the front of his shirt, my face in close to his. Stop this! Just because you keep repeating it doesn't mean it's true. B breaks away, goes into the lounge and sits down, head in hands. I retake my seat while Jay tries to speak to him. Just then the front door opens and C enters. He sits down beside B and tells him that he doesn't appreciate getting a text message at 3:30 a.m. informing him that B is going to sleep in his bed. B looks extremely contrite. He mumbles something about having to sleep in a bed because of his epilepsy, but C isn't interested and continues to remark on the lack of thought and respect in him and B's behaviour. I sit in the kitchen, chuckling quietly.